So one of my absolute favorite games and series is Elder Scrolls, but my particular favorite is Morrowind. And I really wanted to talk about the world of Morrowind. That was kind of one of the, I guess, starting points for when I wanted to do this podcast. And I was thinking about people to bring on to talk about Morrowind. And I thought, you know, maybe I should grab my friend Arimithias here. He knows so much about Morrowind. So let me introduce to you Arimithias. How are you doing today, Arimithias?
Not too badly, thank you. It's a little chilly, but apart from that, it's all good.
I like the chilly over the encroaching heat death that I have living right beside a river.
Yeah.
And hopefully the bugs will go away.
Yes, hopefully.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
So, Arimithias, give me a little bit of a background on you, your interests in the Elder Scrolls, and kind of give me like the elevator pitch and deep history at the same time of your relationship with it.
Okay, so you're pulling me in two different directions here.
I am.
Okay. Right. Well, I started off with the Elder Scrolls with Morrowind. It was in 2002. He had dyspraxia, but one of my classmates was allowed a laptop in lessons to type because his handwriting was atrocious and slow. And if he ever got bored, it was a powerful enough laptop by 2002 standards that you could just whip it out and play games. And he was smart enough in the uptake that he got bored regularly in his lessons. So I'd be sitting there regularly, and just kind of seeing these flashes of Vardenfell over my shoulder as I'm going through philosophy class, and just kind of like, what? But hang on, is that a bug? Is that what's going on? Okay, so we've got someone wearing a dress, wielding a katana, killing some sort of green thing that has mandibles. Okay.
That's way more interesting than a lecture. In any case.
Yes. Yeah, and depending on the lesson, the teacher would join in as well. If we'd kind of gone through the material content, he just kind of sit down and comment on the games because there was nothing else to do. The syllabus was that basic that he could just kind of run through it in half an hour and just otherwise he'd just spend the rest of the time commenting on how the guy played Half-Life. So yeah,
throw that barrel over there. All right, now see if you can pick that up with your gravity gun.
Yeah.
By the way, philosophy, Socrates. Let's go back to that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but yeah, that his other big thing was Arnold Schwarzenegger, which somehow made its way into most lessons. But
philosophy. It's like highbrow philosophy people. Look at them. Look at them.
Yeah, as I was going to say, a Baptist minister teaching philosophy and waxing lyrical about Arnold Schwarzenegger. That was my kind of sixth form experience and the context for my introduction to Morrowind.
And I'm here
I kind of got that introduction to it, and then just tried to wrestle with it to get my machine to work with it, and had a limited measure of success. Played it through pretty much every playthrough apart from my current one. In all of the years since I've been playing it, pretty much has been a Telvanni Nightblade. I tend to always play the same character for whatever reason. It's just Morrowind is home. I go home to be who I am.
Yeah, you have crafted your skill over the years, and by God, why change that?
Because exactly.
Increasingly more difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, but and I just kind of dipped in and out of the game throughout that time, but got into the lore around kind of 2008-ish. It was kind of I saw the Bethesda forums. I was posting stuff on there about how do I get this mod to work sort of questions, and then it's like, ooh, there's lore as well, and then just caught up with, oh, there's that, oh wow, these guys are bringing in Hinduism, they're bringing in they're bringing in all sorts of ancient religious stuff. They're referencing all the books. I mean, yeah, because I'd seen the books and kind of worked through them, but I don't tend to read books in game. I will, I'll tend to go to somewhere like typically the Imperial Library to just read the stuff in my own time. But just after that point, I got involved with the Bethesda forums as far as I could. I mean, I'm in the UK, so by I finished school and started posting. And by the time I woke up again, everyone else had the discussion. It was over, and I just couldn't contribute anything else. But yeah,
you're kind of the Night's Watch. Let me fill in the blank spaces as much as I can.
Yeah, pretty much. Which was infuriating because there was some magnificent stuff going around the forums at the kind of the times that I was kind of most active around kind of 2010, 2012. There was some beautiful, beautiful stuff in the official forums that I could just read and marvel, basically. After that point, and well, when I had a machine that would run Skyrim, and by run, I mean it would boot, pretty much. My experience with Elder Scrolls games is that I will mod them to hell and back, and they will probably come out at about 12 frames per second on whatever machine I've got to run. So yeah, I got back into Skyrim, carried on playing, carried on what involvement I could with the lore community, and then kind of found podcasts during a particularly bad spell at work in 2014, and just blazed my way through all of the lore podcasts I could find there, and then just thought, well, hang on, I want something more than this. I'm desperate to know more about the weirder stuff, and so after I'd finished the Selectives Lorecast, because I've joined them now, but they're still going. But once I'd got through their earlier episodes, which were happening at about that time at work, I just thought, okay, so all of the other stuff that I could find, which was, I think at that point, the Elder Lore podcast, and that was it. Mm-hmm. And is all the basic stuff. So I started thinking, well, could I start producing some stuff that was the more advanced things? And then the Lore Seekers podcast and the Elder Scrolls podcast scene just went boom around 2017, 2018. And I kind of joined in thinking, yes, I'm going to be the one for the next step up. It's kind of, if you've mastered the basics of what an Argonian is, what a Khajiit is, and then want to know, but hang on, what's all this Chim stuff I keep on hearing about, and how do dragon breaks work? I just thought I would unpack
like
all
that. The PhD program of lore.
Yeah, well, ish, and kind of a bit of archaeology too, because you've heard me talking about the years that I've kind of been in touch with the fandom, because I've seen it kind of evolve. Mm-hmm. Over all that time, and people will know about all these ideas, and so they'll say, oh, I've heard this because someone said it works this way, and so I'm thinking, yeah, does it really work like that? That's not what I picked up when I read XYZ. And so it's kind of, okay, so where all do these ideas all come from? Let's go back to the text, let's go and dig up how everything's evolved. That was kind of my idea for Written in Uncertainty, which is kind of fueled my involvement with the community as such. If you ever want to learn more about a subject, teach it to someone else, because you got to make sure you know your stuff first.
You do. You definitely do, because you don't want to when I do research segments on this podcast, it's like I have to double check and make sure I can't just like, you know, sit around and have a glass of beer and talk about this or that. Like, you gotta make sure that everything is referenced and that when you're saying something, you can back it up.
Yep.
Because you feel the need to be the source of truth, and you don't want to look like or seem like that you are just, you know, pulling stuff out of your butt, essentially.
True. But then again, what is truth?
Oh, here we go. All right, are you going to talk about Arnold Schwarzenegger next? Is that what?
Maybe. We can talk about Vivek and blunt weapons, but that's where I was going to go with that.
The interesting thing, I think you were talking about getting Skyrim and playing it on like the lowest settings and stuff. That's where I started. I started with Oblivion and picked that up right when it released. And I had like the fog all the way up because it wouldn't run or else. And so it was on the lowest graphical settings, and I didn't know how to open up a mini map. at that time. Like I wasn't used to PC gaming 100%. So that world seemed like somewhere between Silent Hills and medieval fantasy all at the same time, because everywhere I go, like going to, for example, the Imperial City, I mean, that in itself was, oh, what's this thing in the fog? Oh, it's a city. Oh, it's not just grass everywhere. But then I went back to my local store and picked up Morrowind, and that ran way better the current setup that I have, and ended up beating and playing a lot more of that before I went back to Oblivion. So kind of almost a reverse, like, oh, I'm playing this, it can't run the greatest, let me go back and play the older one to see if I like it.
Yeah.
But played a lot of that throughout my years. I wasn't as much into the lore. I was more into that was like my first, I guess, foray into RPGs, and so it was like, how can I make a character that can do this particular thing? Like when you find the scroll in the ground that lets you fly across the map, and it's like the experimental. So it's like, okay, how can I make a character that can kind of do that all the time? That way, I don't have to take the netches around, or I think that's what they're called. The
Silt Striders.
Yeah, the Silt Striders, yeah.
They do look like netches, in fairness.
Well, I mean, you would be the expert, and of course, here I am confusing the both of them, you know. I'm showing, it's like, you know, you it's like dumb and incredibly more superior intellect when it comes to Morrowind.
No, I just know that I'm better at sounding like I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, I think that's the key for anyone who's smart, is sound like they know what they're talking about. So let me start you with a very deep question that I'm sure is going to get the people involved. So if Morrowind monsters like the Netch and the Silt Strider are Pokemon, who was your starter Pokemon?
I think, well, there is my answer here, and there is a right answer here. I just want to qualify that.
Okay.
And they're different.
Okay, let's hear them both.
I would say the Kaguti, simply because they're the more substantial of kind of Morrowind's monsters, because you get far enough in and you realize that all of the stuff you're fighting is basically a mouth on legs, because you have an Elitz, you have Elitz, you have Gwars, you have Kagutis, and they're basically about 40-50% the same models, but Kagutis are the ones that are with the horns and the Triceratops like head crest is the word I'm looking for, the kind of and they just look that much more aggressive. They've got tusks and everything. So yeah, if I was going to have something to start a fight with, then it would be one of those. The correct answer is one singular monster which you will not find anywhere in the games. It is the Pocket Cabal, which
yes.
Which, just to unpack, is one of the children of Vivek and Molag Bal. In the 36 lessons, Vivek and Molag Bal have a whole bunch of children together, and quite a few of the sermons are Vivek going around killing them all afterwards. But sermon 26 is where you find the Pocket Cabal, and it is apparently a giant Pokemon reference.
Really?
So you have just a ton of different nods to it. So it's like the monster hid itself in the spell lists of the great Chimeri wizards of the extreme east, where the Emperor Parasols grew wild, which is just, yeah, it's Japan, and just the way and the landscape you find in Pokemon. And then later on, and you have, and so of course a giant bug appeared, and it's just and there are just these little nods about capturing the Pocket Cabal, and then Sothasil wants to keep it. And
yeah, because I've gone beyond my knowledge based speculation. Isn't there like a continent that's beside, I guess, what we consider Tamriel, that's like to the far east, that has those like Eastern like Eastern culture, and that's where like you have a lot. There's some sort of other continent that we haven't seen in the games before. I'm pretty sure. Am I correct?
You're thinking about Akavir, yeah.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's the name.
Yep. And you look at all the stylings that have come from there, and that's the weapons particularly are quite samurai inspired. They're literally called katanas in Morrowind and tantos and so on. But there was quite a deliberate, one of the developers was quite deliberate in saying, no, we can't have just a straight Japan analog. So we're going to have a bunch of vampire snakes eat all of them. which is where the Stacey came from. So yes, there is absolutely that kind of Eastern inspired stuff going on in the games, but there's also the, no, we can't have that.
We would butcher that if we really tried.
Yeah. Which it's, now I think about it, there's a whole bunch of stuff that's basically just knee-jerk reactions to saying, no, we can't be typical fantasy, that this particular developer, Michael Kirkbride, did. The Sijic Order, which you might have heard about, they're basically one of the most powerful orders of mages.
They're like Doctor Who, essentially, right?
Pretty much. Yeah.
I'm the great foil for you because that's like Doctor Who, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. Because they just kind of phase in and out of reality and just pop in back in and deal with Tamriel's troubles and then disappear off again and don't really care for centuries, which is basically how Doctor Who works. But they were called Sijics. Because he was like, no, we can't have anyone later on coming along and saying, right, now we have psychic powers in the Elder Scrolls. Let's just take that word and deal with it, and just make it unusable by anything else that would be remotely conventional. And I think the Bosma were an attempt at that as well. It's like, okay, we've got to have we have elves and they live in the wood. Oh, right, that's boring. Okay, let's make them cannibals.
Cannibals, yeah.
Yeah, they love the trees so much they can't eat them. Yeah. So, and that's again the kind of the knee-jerk reaction against all those standard stereotypes, but that's kind of fueled an awful lot of the Elder Scrolls elements, shall we say.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because like a lot of this is inspired from essentially Tolkien, and that's kind of a starting point for most of this. But it seems like even when they like incepted these games in like the very early like Arena and Daggerfall, that they were thinking like, okay, we can't go forward and just have this thing. We can't have like dark elves be dark elves from like D&D. We have to make them different and have this kind of, you know, oh, their skin is ash because of the volcano, and they have these, you know, what's a good word? Demigod deities that they worship, and there's like this whole like varying culture. Same thing for the wood elves and the Nords with the dragons and all of that. Like the first people, the first men and their expeditions, like back in the day.
Yeah, Morans.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah. You know what? If I have any questions, man, you were the guy to go to. You are the thing. If I had to pick though or my starter Pokemon for Morrowind, I think it would be a Nyxox, which is my favorite mount in ESO because essentially I play an Argonian, but he sits on top. It's like this ball that he sits on top, you know, that looks like a Nyxox. And he has these little spider legs that move around. And everybody else is like riding lions and stuff. And I'm like riding this like really strange spider. I look like the, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Wild Wild West with Will Smith. I look like a spider from that. There's a gigantic mechanical spider. I wouldn't recommend actually watching that movie. It's pretty dated. We tried to watch it a little bit ago and it's pretty offensive.
I've heard that. I've heard that it's not aged well.
It did not. But that would be my starter just because, first of all, I mean, you can ride it. Second of all, it looks pretty crazy. And I mean, if it can put like a humanoid creature on its back and be chill about it, it's got to be strong, you know?
Yeah, well, there's the ability to be strong, as in to pull a lot of stuff and to take a lot of weight, and then there's the ability to tear other things to shreds. I don't know what you prefer in terms of Pokemon strategy.
Right.
I've only played the original game. I haven't done anything since. So
I am increasingly unsure of what Pokemon is, but I would imagine that maybe that would be good for a merchant and maybe not somebody who is like, you know,
yeah,
battling Daedra or something of the like.
Yeah.
So Morrowind obviously has this like crazy setting that really stands out. So why do you think it stands out from more traditional Western RPGs like Dragon Age or The Witcher or you know?
Basically, I think the main reason for that is because it has a ton of kind of non-Western ideas at what has become the core of it. It's difficult to kind of track the evolution of it because everything's quite so muddled up. Because you say that the Dark Elves are different from Morrowind. I don't think they were from when the Elder Scrolls was started. They were kind of thinly veiled drow. In Daggerfall, right down to being promiscuous and this, that, and the other, and matriarchal, and so on.
I know a little bit about that just from I think it was an R.A. Salvatore book that he did that was about Dirk, maybe was the Dark Elf's name. I think it's like a series of books just about this one Dark Elf, and he, I think, rides a spider as well, or has spider friends.
Yeah, that sounds about right. But yeah, it's kind of got Morrowind's kind of taken those ideas, and it was the first main game just after they did a whole load of changes to the lore, and kind of benefited the most from that, if you like. The kind of the basis for modern lore is the Pocket Guide to the Empire, and Morrowind was the first. That shipped with the Elder Scrolls Adventures Redguard. It was basically a Tomb Raider clone that Bethesda made, and they released a whole bunch of the lore in that. And Morrowind was the first main game to come after that. So it kind of they kind of felt the need to, as far as I understand it, make something fairly different. But it was also partway through the development of of the game, so they were planning to make the Elder Scrolls 3 in Somerset. Originally, and then they just said no, it's got to be something different, and apparently the pitch was that it needs to be Dark Crystal meets Star Wars was kind of the elevator pitch for it.
I can see Dark Crystal. Yeah, I don't know if I could see 100% Star Wars, but I could definitely see Dark Crystal. I mean, in the towns or like, you know, like Tatooine, like you walk in a bar and you get the whole cantina scene.
Yeah, no, you get kind of like the Tatooine aesthetic from Alderaan, particularly, I feel like. Mm-hmm. And then you go to Sadrith Mora and look at the Telvanni, and then look at the Skeksis from Dark Crystal, the villains, and the aesthetics are so similar. It's just, I think that's part of the reason why it stands out, is that it hides its origins so well.
Yeah.
Because it smashes a whole bunch together.
Now that you've said Dark Crystal, that's like, I'm thinking, oh yeah, of course. Like, I've never thought about how that film, because I, as a kid, I mean, obviously, like, if you watch that film as a kid, it's like an amazing, like, transportation film that takes you to this, like, other world. And I'm still mad at Netflix for canceling the Muni series as well.
It's kidding. I hadn't heard that. Yes, oh, I'm sad now. Yeah, but it also takes a whole bunch of other ideas that from real world sources as well that aren't typically taken, because you have, well, I'm trying to think kind of the way that faith and religion and gods typically function in RPGs is they kind of take the kind of the Greco-Roman model almost. There's a god of storms, there's a god of warriors, there's a god of wisdom, and they all squabble all the time, occasionally do things with mortals. It's quite a Greco-Roman basis to it. But Morrowind takes a different approach to it, that you look at quite a few of the inspirations, and there's For some of the cosmology that came out with that game, it draws from Gnostic Christianity and the kind of the Gnostic views of the world, as well as elements of Hinduism and various other things. So it's a grab bag of archetypes that aren't really used in other places. Is why I think it's quite so different. And the landscape is a kind of a huge part of that, because you don't usually play games that are blasted wasteland. I mean, Dune as a alternative world setting. I won't say fantasy because it's not, but Dune as a sci-fi setting is not your typical sci-fi setting at all. And Morrowind is kind of the same, because it's just a wasteland and totally distinct from Tolkien's setting. I mean, you could perhaps make an argument that Mordor is similar to Morrowind, but it's not entirely, because it's kind of blasted dark and dingy and all the rest of it, but it's not right. The main focus of the narrative in the way that Morrowind's landscape is.
That's what I thought when I read Dune, I was like, this is kind of unlike anything that I have ever read as far as like world building and what they're talking about. And so it was funny to read Dune and then see people like, I didn't really get into Game of Thrones until later, like the books themselves, and people going on and on about them, and then reading Game of Thrones, and I was like, oh, this is just Dune with less funny words. the writing style is very similar. It's like, oh, here's this house hates this house, here's some members from their house, are they worried about their placement within the greater world? Yes, they are.
Like, yeah, but then you look at Dune and you realize, oh, it's just Lawrence of Arabia with the serial numbers filed off.
Yep, there's that too.
Oh yeah, there is nothing new under the sun.
No, and I think that's good, and I think that riffing on that kind of stuff, like, you know, taking this and moving it into a modern setting, and even last week we were talking about superheroes and how like that is a riff on Greek mythology and Roman mythology, Nordic, so on and so forth, and how that is good, but there are some benefits and I guess some not very good things that could come from that, just in terms of culture degrading. But to kind of pull away from that, one of the things that I'm really into in games is pathing. And to go from a lot of the open world RPGs that came out at that time, there was fast travel was a thing. And so you would go and you would select, okay, I'm going to this place, and it would automatically kind of take you there. And that's become kind of the norm for a lot of different open world games, unless you're specifically changing the variables. Like, you can do that in Skyrim, for example, but if you mod it so that you can't, or use a survival mode so that you can only travel to certain places, then that would change it, of course. But natively, fast travel is still a thing. So do you think that Morrowind benefits from a lack of immediate fast travel?
Yes, because it forces you to experience the world. It forces you to go through it in a way that you don't have to otherwise. I mean, to take Skyrim as an example, you do have to travel everywhere once. And it depending on the game, you can sometimes fast travel straight to a place, sometimes not. But it also forces you to kind of get to know the place. Like, if I go back in, it's like, okay, I'm in Saedanin, I can walk to Balmorrow with my eyes closed, sort of thing. Because you can get used to knowing the game and the roots of the game, because you have to travel them so much. It gives it that kind of lived-in feel that much more. And I think also what fast travel that there is also another way of enhancing the world, because there is fast travel in Morrowind. It's just you have to pay for it, and it's limited, because right. you have the Mage's Guild guides that will send you to places, and you have the Salt Striders that will take you to various places. But it's integrated into the world. It adds things to how the world works, and you start to. I don't know whether you necessarily start to understand why the world's shaped like it is. That's what I was about to say, but I'm not sure that's quite true. Because you don't get to see kind of natural flows of commerce, so to speak, through those networks, but it gives you a sense that there could be those things. And because you have to basically use what the average Joe would probably use rather than just bamf and you're there.
Right. It's kind of like a bus system almost. It's kind of like you got to start like everybody else. You got to take the bus. If you want to get there, you got to go to the bus stop to get on the bus. Yep. But then once you've, you know, done the main quest and you've leveled up and stuff, you're like floating above gates and like jumping these great distances so that it's like, okay, I could probably get there faster and for less money if I do this kind of weird combination of magic to launch myself across the map.
Yeah, and that forces a particular kind of innovation. It's not one that I've tried personally, but yeah, I can absolutely see that.
I see every Bethesda game as a thing to break. That's how I've always played them, is like, how can I physically not like go into the command console and do all the different stuff, or, you know, knowingly cheat, but it's like, how do I break this game? How do I do something that I can do that they don't want me to do?
My usual one with that is the fortify intelligence loop with Morrowind, but
there was one I was looking at I got in Skyrim on the Switch, and I was getting tired. I was like, I really don't want to level my smithing up to level 100 for this amount of time. And I was like, and I can't, like, you can't like command console anything. You can't really do anything. So I was like, how do you do this? And it ended up being, you make this potion and then you start enhancing, you make this potion that enhances your potion making ability. And so you get in this positive feedback loop where you're continually making these potions back and forth until it fortifies something to this like insane degree, like this number that's in the trillions. And the game doesn't understand that. And then when you go to enchant something, it just throws everything off. And then you can make essentially a ring that automatically allows you to make these crazy potions that give you a bunch of experience, these crazy armors that like do all this different stuff. And it blew my mind, like the amount of stuff you could actually break within the game that I had not done before. Like, I was like, how do you go from to this level? It's like, normally it's me just like trying to jump at a certain angle so I can, you know, go up a mountain, which is kind of the gist of a lot of my experience with Bethesda games.
Yep, that's definitely a Bethesda trope, that the mountains to try and funnel you a particular direction. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that's the case in Morrowind too, because you have the mountain, the volcano. What's the name of the volcano? Because I've forgotten, and you probably know.
The red mountain.
Red mountain. You red know, mountain. It's funny because I am like pretty into it and have read even the I really like the books, like the ones about there was like a floating island that was like up in the, I don't know if, did you get a chance to read those?
The novels, I haven't yet. But no, you're thinking The Infernal City and Lord of Souls.
I actually ended up really liking that as like a fantasy book to start out with, because you already knew the world. Like, if you played the games, you already knew the world, and they didn't need to explain it to you. Like, you didn't need to know what a Khajiit was. Like, you didn't need to, they didn't have to go down this rabbit hole. And then they ended up linking the setting through a number of different things, but it was kind of a contained story in itself that added in on a lot of the different cultures that they don't talk about.
Now that's kind of my worry, though. That's why I've been kind of put off reading those books, because I'm thinking, well, how much is the author just going to say it's an Argonian and not bother with an actual description?
Until they get there are certain points that I don't want to spoil anybody, because I really like, if you're thinking about picking up a fantasy book, they're actually like just as books pretty good. But some of the different things that they talk about with Argonian politics, I think, are very interesting, because with the I think it's called the Zaxliel. It's like the political force, I think, in Argonia after the Dark Elves all leave, and they're kind of like this.
The Anzaliel is the party, but Saxaliel is what they take on as their name. You are not an Argonian, name. You're a Saxaliel. Right. Yeah. But anyway,
And then their whole, like, let's drink a bunch of sap. Like, when the Oblivion Gates open, let's drink a bunch of sap and let's go kick some butt as these, like, Captain America style Argonians.
Yes. Yeah.
But to kind of, I guess, get back in the fast travel, I love. I love the system that they have. And you talked about kind of paths, and it's like, okay, you can do like the road from Balmora to Nissus with your eyes closed or something like that.
Yep.
And it's funny to do it. Okay, I'm going to do like go to the city once. And the time, because there's a lot of quests that you have to kind of go back and forth between cities. Mm-hmm. And eventually you're on your like your third or fourth time, and it's like, okay, there's a path that leads that way. Let me go down that one. And then you realize that that connects to another path, and that's actually a faster way in between a city that's maybe in a different area. And so then in you start doing this mental mapping, which is a thing that we all do, even with things in our household, things in our neighborhood. Like, you don't need to think about it. Like, I could ask you to draw a map of your own neighborhood, and you would be able to do it from your perspective of how you think about things. And it's one of the few games that allows that it's like, okay, I know how to do that. I'm trying to think of other, a lot of Metroidvanias, like Dark Souls is another type of thing where it's like, okay, I now know the paths to take. I can get from one area to the other without having to do all of these, you know, roundabout ways of taking all these elevators. It's like, I know the one shortcut to do it. And I think Morrowind is an even greater example of that, where, I mean, eventually you know the map. You know the map probably if you've played through the game and like spent the amount of hours that you would in a regular Elder Scrolls game. By the end of it, you're 100% familiar with the location.
Yeah. No, because you have to be in it so much. It's and the lack of waypoints also helps you with that. Well, I say helps, mm-hmm. but it's just okay. Go here. It's just southeast of here. Okay, and then you realize that that's totally the wrong direction. Or because they'll say, oh yeah, you travel down this road until you see a pile of rocks. Then you turn right, and it's the fourth cave on your left. And it's not at all.
it's funny because, like, I mean, back then the graphics were not as detailed as they were today. So you kind of had to know, like, this pile of rocks, or oh, I've reached the tree, and now I have to. There's not a lot of, other than the signs, I guess. There's not a lot of real waypoints and systems within it, and it's interesting to go and play the because they remade it for Elder Scrolls Online, and it's interesting to go and play that, and it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I know exactly where everything is. I can go from here to there. I kind of get the gist of everything, but everything is a little bit different. It's not you know, it's definitely changed from the original.
Yeah, and the scale is silly as well, because like I can get from Vivek City to Saint Denis in about 3 minutes.
Yeah,
which is just no, that it's. Well, I mean, it depends. I don't tend to jump around the map. I mean, your experience may be different. So.
Yeah, you know, let me tell you something. I'm like I'm trying to think good. I'm like a levitating, well, I guess in the sense of the game, I'm a levitating demigod. I'm a demigod no matter what, but or at least I believe that I am. No matter what, but I'm always, I generally play a mage in some regards. I'm just working with like small arms, like just like swords and stuff, just because the combat is not exactly the most in depth as far as like mechanically RPG sense it makes it there. But I like experimenting more with the magic system, where it's like, okay, you can create your own custom spells, which is something I sorely miss in Skyrim. You could do it in Oblivion, but the amount of the I guess the variation of spells that you could do, or you could just like summon stuff. Like you could just like, oh, okay, let me just summon this crazy creature, and let me summon like three of them at the same time. Let me make sure to fortify my acrobatics up to this amount, and then I'm gonna leap over this mountain. Like you become this fable-esque character if you do that. And you're not exactly like powerful in combat, but you're just like, in general, a very like tricky son of a bitch, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely.
Have you ever wondered how deep the Elder Scrolls lore rabbit hole goes? Have you got a grasp of the basics and want to find out more about the universe? Written in Uncertainty is here to help you. We'll be mixing in philosophy, theology, and whatever other theory is useful with Elder Scrolls texts to untangle some of the biggest questions in the series, like what are dragon breaks, how does Chim work, where did the Dwemer go, and more. Check us out at writteninuncertainty.com or find Written in Uncertainty on any podcatcher. Thanks for listening, and catch you later in the grey maybe of Tamriel.
This episode is brought to you by Gamefly. Gamefly is the video game rental service that they send you games every month if you're subscribed to their service, and it could be new games. It could be stuff like the new Crash Bandicoot. It could be Marvel's Avengers. It could be older games. You never know. Here's what I would recommend. I would recommend you get some Nintendo games because the Switch has very low memory and the cartridges are pretty good. And then it saves all your save data, so if you like it, you can go buy it once you're done. The offer I have for you today is 60 days for $10. That's 60 days for $10. Essentially, that's just 30 free days. So go ahead, go down to the link in the description, check out the offer from Gamefly. That's the ad.
So moving on, in kind of, you know, these books and the amount of lore within the world, they're scattered throughout the whole game. There's like houses that you go into, and like, you know, kind of like when you go into a hotel in America, you're going to find a Bible in the little drawer. There's more common ones, there's less common ones, there's magic books, and I mean even in Skyrim, that reach out tentacles and suck you into a different world. So how do you think that books enhance this game as opposed to other RPGs, and I'm going to keep on saying Dragon Age and The Witcher, where a lot of the story is kind of like right in front of you and you can grasp it all from there?
Oh, yeah. There's two things that I think having it as books does. In the first sense of having books rather than just having the story, or just being presented with, yes, and the world was created as some sort of prologue as you log into the game and it loads, it makes the whole place feel a bit deeper, because it feels like you're scratching the surface. I mean, the way that you come across the books in game, just incidentally, oh, there's a book here that's giving you the first five Septim emperors, and then oh, this is continued in book three, which isn't anywhere near you, that you have to then hunt down, and just it makes it feel like part of a much richer tapestry, that it feels like you're just scratching the surface because you're incidentally dipping in and there's all these different elements to it. I mean, the Lord of the Rings does this as well. And by the Lord of the Rings, I don't mean just Middle Earth. I mean the Lord of the Rings story. There's odd little nods, like Aragorn talks about the cat being as quiet as the cats of Queen Burethiel or something. And when Frodo is confronted with Shelob, he shouts out Ea Ayarendil Elenion Elenion Ankalima, if I can actually get my pronunciation remotely right, which I didn't.
You did it way better than I could, let me tell you something.
For someone who actually studied Quenya, I'm disappointed in myself. I got very bored in a job, but that presentation and that the translation of that, which is something like Hail Arendil, brightest of all lights, which we then get given somewhere in the book. And you don't get any other explanation in The Lord of the Rings, but it obviously means something. And so who is it? Who is Arendil? But there's obviously more meaning to that. And it gives it that feeling of, ooh, this is meaty, without actually giving you anything. And I think having the books present that way in the game helps with that sort of a feeling. It makes the whole place feel a bit more lived. And the second thing is that most books have a named author. All books have an author, generally, that you're never getting the complete picture out of any one book. So you can read two books about the same thing and get completely different perspectives. And so you can think, so what actually happened? I mean, the Battle of Red Mountain is kind of the example of this, but this sense of you can get so many different perspectives on something rather than just what you see in the games.
Right. There's information bias, and part of the fun, I guess, when you dig that deep into it, is deciding for yourself what you think happened and what your perspective on it is. You almost gain your own separate like perspective on what exactly went down.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of you. In some games, headcanon is something that you kind of develop. In the Elder Scrolls, you have to develop your own headcanon, if you want to put it that way, because right. you need to fill in those gaps to try and understand it, or you're probably going to be wrong on several particulars. If you just take information as it's presented to you, you're going to get something wrong.
I mean, even when we think about ancient history in the world, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we just don't know because the information wasn't there. And so, like, scholars and doctors and people that have studied for years and years have to create a believable headcanon that's then put out into, like, it's well researched. It's you know, it has a lot of things backing it up, but we don't know that the details of this or that happen in that way. And it's interesting. I have a buddy that was like spent his entire one of his graduate programs was talking about like the Roman word for camps and what a camp meant. And it was it like a small dwelling for someone, or was it like this army thing? How did they function in society? And it's all these things that we don't know and kind of have to pull some details from here and there. And then the things that survived from a lot of that time were these fantastical stories like the Iliad and the Odyssey, and you know, the list could go on with that stuff. But that's what survived. And so you're kind of like taking what these authors and their take on what happened and making your own take, deciding what's believable, what's unbelievable. So you kind of have to do that in the real world with a lot of the stuff that we don't have information on.
Yeah, it's one of the things that mildly bugs me about the lore, actually, that you do have to do that, and it's I'm kind of on board with Zorkanov. He does the Imperial Knowledge YouTube channel, where he's kind of said that it's infuriating because you have to do that for information that is current in the Elder Scrolls quite often, that you're dealing with current cultures, current events, and there should be enough people around to tell you some details. But because you only have those two or three sources, you do have to patch it together. I think part of that's just the nature of the games, that you kind of butt up against the limits of what the game developers can write. Otherwise, they'd have to write a whole history. And
I think that's natural for the times that we... Like for these times that we live in, where like history evolves itself, we learn more stuff or we forget certain things, and then the current telling of a particular story is different from how they told it 50 years ago, and like that in itself is interesting. Of like these people that are this company that's trying to manage this gigantic like lore that is on par with a lot of the major works of Tolkien and that style of stuff. To do all that and to bring different people in, there's not been the same person that's controlling every single detail. Like I know that Star Wars, when they got bought up by Disney, there was like a dude that's like, yep, my job is to make sure that everything lines up together. And I think it's almost more believable in a sense. And I know it's probably frustrating, but to have it change up almost in every single iteration because time has passed. The only problem I see is when you go back in time for a certain amount. So like the stuff in Elder Scrolls Online, which is the most recent iteration of it all, I'm pretty sure. Stuff has changed and it's like stuff almost has evolved from there. And they're probably riffing off of stuff that they had said in Skyrim. Skyrim is riffing off of Oblivion. But it's interesting to see, I guess that would be the annoying part, is like to have that entry go kind of progress forward, but also be historically behind at the same time.
Yeah, it depends. With ESO, they tie up an awful lot of loose ends. Mm-hmm. They go back and reference a whole bunch of stuff from the earlier games. Like there's the plot line of ESO Somerset that talks about the Crystal Tower and that being present in all dimensions at once. That's one line of text that was in Arena. That they've built it off, and a whole bunch of the dungeons like Fang Lair, Selene's Web, and Labyrinthian and all that, that was in the Elder Scrolls Arena. That all of those places were already there. So you've got that basis, and and you can see where they're at the same time trying to an extent revise what's gone before, and also kind of make put more meat on the bones of what was there before. It's I don't know, I always tend to kind of drift towards the meta perspective of the development, but I just think it's really fascinating from kind of looking at how they've built it out and what they're changing and so on.
And it's easy, it's funny to see, like, I think a very easy, like, simple translation can turn into something rather funny. So, like, for example, the Khajiit, in which are the cat people that live in Tamriel, they have always talked about how there are, a Khajiit could be anywhere from like an actual lion to like what we perceive as a lion. It could be a very large humanoid, like a giant cat person. It could be a regular sized cat person. It could also just be a cat. Like, and to see that like executed on that scale, where it's like you're talking to cats, you're talking to lions, you're talking to giant cat people, like that translation of it, and then seeing it, like we hadn't seen that before in the games until so to see it in that game, it's like, this is kind of crazy, this is kind of wild stuff here.
Yeah, which I don't know, there's part of me that almost veers the other way, that that you've got all this crazy stuff that gets talked about, and you kind of see around the edges, and then you see it in the full light of day when you see it in the games, and it's kind of it can be quite underwhelming if they kind of redevelop it to be something else. I mean, the best example of that is Cyrodiil, because it was in the pocket guide to the Empire.
It was like a jungle, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the line is that most is endless jungle, and that got repeated in Morrowind, and then you got Oblivion, which is set I think about 7-8 years after Morrowind. I can't remember the dates precisely.
Pretty close, yeah.
And then it's just temperate forest, and you're just kind of like, where? Why did you do this to me? I was expecting a tropical Venice, there's still that. There's that element to it as well. Seeing the stuff around the edges is kind of good. And just to bring it back to Morrowind, what you're talking about, the fog really adds to the feel of it, in my perspective. I've played it with graphics extenders where there's no fog, and you kind of look out from a high perspective, and it's like, okay, I can see all of this stuff. I mean, it looks kind of neat, but I can see it all.
So let's kind of jump from that, from fog itself. So there's a lot of environmental within Morrowind that they're having to deal with, one of them being Red Mountain. And there's a number of other things that happen in the game. So it seems like to me that Morrowind is kind of in this constant state of environmental crisis, but it always seems like the Dark Elves are kind of unprepared for it, or are not fully understanding of the situation. Why do you think that is?
I have my own reasons, and I'm not sure that it's unprepared as such, but I want to ask you a question to start with that. Just what would preparedness look like to you in that situation? What do you expect the Dark Elves to do?
What do I expect the Dark Elves to do? I think maybe look holistically at problems rather than looking for temporary solutions. I think that it's like the volcano has always been a case, like you'd figured that they would be the most expert people of, like, okay, you know, maybe we should, you know, do something to contain this problem, to contain, okay, we know that this bad dude is going to come out in these 1,000 years and he's going to cause this havoc, so why don't we put some safeguards within that itself? Or, you know, a better example is Vivek stops a giant meteor from falling into the ground, and then he stops it but doesn't think about, okay, if I'm gone, or if something happens to the magic that actually stopped this, then it's going to crash into the ground, which it does in the series.
Yes.
So that's kind of why don't they think about things more holistically? What stops them from that? To me, it seems like that it's a matter of tradition and religion. Like, it is like, like everything is so obfuscated in this. You know, there's a number of different religions within the game itself, and a number of different houses and politics that build off of each other. It's almost like they get kind of lost in the weeds. So, and I'm curious what your perspective is.
Yeah, I think what you're seeing as a bug, I'm seeing as a feature. if I can put it that way. It's not, I don't think the Dunmer are unprepared necessarily. I mean, for Red Mountain, possibly, because as far as I can remember, there's the Red Year in the fifth year of the fourth era, and there was the eruption after the Battle of Red Mountain in the year 700 of the first era, which that's
that means a whole lot to me. I'm now on the page, I'm trying
to work out the times in my head, but yeah, to give you an idea, the first era ended in the year 2920.
Okay.
The second era ended in about the year 800 and something, and the third era ended in about the year 400 or so, at the point of the Oblivion Crisis, 450 or thereabouts.
And I liken the games that when they decide to end the era, it's always when something big happens, and they're like, "All right, you know what? That's big enough. Why don't we just end this era?" And they're all like,
"It's all political decisions as to what sets it." But just on those dates, from what we know of when Red Mountain erupted, it's been thousands of years since it's happened. So I kind of forgive them for being unprepared for Red Year erupting and all the rest of it, because they haven't had to deal with Red Mountain erupting for ages. But even if they did, I think that the philosophy that undergirds the Dunmer is one that celebrates suffering. I mean, Veloth left Somerset with the original Chimer left this land of plenty and good climate and indolence to this really harsh, ash-blasted landscape because they wanted a more aesthetic, more pure way of being. They wanted life to be a challenge. So if they're struggling to cope with the environment, that's the way it should be as far as the roots of their culture are concerned. I think they may have evolved away from that a bit with the Tribunal, because of how the Tribunal seemed to be encouraging stuff and virtues that...
For people that don't know, I will refrain from explaining it, but what exactly is the Tribunal? Because I think that's probably one of the... You understand that there's like this pantheon of kind of these... Almost like what's a good word? Like a more Western pantheon of gods that are more, I guess, relative to Christianity. Then there's the kind of pagan pantheon of gods that are the Daedra. And then you have the Tribunal. So what exactly is the Tribunal?
Okay. Just to go through the list, the Aedra, which are the Aedra or the Divines, which is the more Christian-y side of things, as you're putting it, is the gods who created the world. Mm-hmm. And so the elves consider them their ancestors. The word Aedra means ancestors. The Daedra is not our ancestors. So those gods and spirits that didn't partake in the creation of the world, which were the original, the things that the Chimer originally worshipped. And they were eventually replaced by the Tribunal, who were, depending on when you're playing the games, three Chimer who basically messed around with the heart of the god who created the mortal plane, and tapped into his power, and made themselves gods, set themselves up over what was then the Dunmer people, because that when they changed themselves into gods, the Chimer became the Dunmer in other related stuff. But yeah, they're basically immortal god kings, is the way I can put it.
And from my perspective, it seems like that they got superpowers and they told everybody that they were gods. They were like, okay, we're not regular like humanoid creatures anymore. We are now superheroes that have these massive powers and sway, but we're not at the level of the Aedra or Daedra.
Yeah. Well, that entirely depends on what your definition of a god is. because as far as I'm concerned with the Elder Scrolls, if someone calls it a god, it's a god. That just saves a whole heap of arguments. But yes, the Tribunal are far from the kind of the pictures of kind of omniscience and everything else that we in our Judeo-Christian mindset, if I can put it that way, expect gods to be like. And the Aedra and the Daedra aren't like that either, is the thing that people seem to miss. I mean, the Aedra created the world. They are things that they are beings that can pull off huge supernatural feats, but so can the Tribunal. The expectation of perfection is possibly a bit too far, but the fact that the Tribunal are mortal in some sense is possibly something to count against them. But in terms of what gods can do and how gods work, it gets a bit muddy in on Tamriel. And also, when you think about what the Dark Elves were worshipping before, it was kind of time for a bit of a change in their society. That they were worshipping Boethia, Azura, and Mephala. Boethia is the prince of plots and involved with the unlawful overthrow of authority and not explicitly death, but it kind of that sort of thing.
I thought that the prince of plots would be a real estate developer.
Possibly. You've got Mephala, who is the spider Daedra of murder, sex, and secrets. And Azura is the twilight goddess of dusk and dawn. And not really a lot else in terms of explicit spheres of influence. But
it seems like that she's kind of implanted in certain areas where it's like, okay, we need like an Athena type here. And then it's like that Azura kind of shows up and is like, somebody called.
Now you say that, I can totally see the Athena elements in Azura. Yeah, I can absolutely see that. But as Athena with the temper turned up.
Yeah.
But that collection of gods isn't really one that's going to produce a stable society, right? Kind of the point I'm getting to. You've got someone who's focused on the unlawful overthrow of authority and secret murder. That's really not going to work in the long term. It's brilliant for an insurgent movement that's desperately trying to get out and overthrow the current government, which is what the Khymer were trying to do in Somerset before they moved to Morrowind. But once they are at Morrowind, they need something different. And so the Tribunal, at least the way the Tribunal put it, they try to take it upon themselves to be that for the Dunmer. It's because they, in their judgment, the Daedra aren't doing the job properly, which, given that set of Daedra, you can kind of understand it.
And so you've got this kind of like base religion of worshiping, you know, murder, sex, and all of this, death and destruction. But then you have the Tribunal that comes and has their own belief systems, and there's inherent problems with that. And that's kind of what you're dealing with for most of at least the main quest of Morrowind. But then you have the Empire, which are from Cyrodiil, that are a collection of a number of different nations that are essentially the Roman Empire, that have their own religion of the Nine or the Aedra. And they're all kind of like pushing on each other a little bit throughout Morrowind. Like, they're all kind of pushing back and forth because Azura intercedes in the beginning of the game and is like, hey, I have this destiny for you that I need you to go and do this stuff. Then you have the Tribunal that are like, I need you to go do this stuff. But then you're part of the Empire because you were a prisoner of theirs, and they have their own kind of agenda with it. So all of these kind of cultures are at the same time like pushing up against each other. My question for you, and this is kind of a deep question, is who do you think is right?
Right in what sense? I get the sense from what you're talking. You're going for who is right in terms of who knows best for the people. Are you asking who is factually correct about the fundamental nature of reality, about which gods are actually gods?
I think both of those, plus who, like, is it, should it just be how it was, where they were just murdering, you know, not murdering, but worshiping these like murderous gods, Whereas the people...
Oh, no, they were murdering as well, but anyway. Murdering
as well, yes. There was a lot of murder, including the main character.
Yep.
There's kind of this, like, original... You know, this original religion for them, and it's almost kind of like there's not only a battle over what the religious state of the continent is, but there's also this like military political game going on, mm-hmm. very associated with these religions as well. With I mean, you've got mm-hmm. the tribunal has all of the ordinators and the different houses, but then you've got the Ashlanders who are not necessarily fond of the tribunal and more mm-hmm. You know, from the more classical perspective of it's like, okay, we really just see them as like these warriors from the stories. We don't necessarily subscribe to that, you know, we don't subscribe to their brand of cool. And then you have the empire that's coming in that's like, okay, we want to make sure that this continent is going well and is a part of the empire, and we bring our own religion into this and are kind of, there's almost kind of like this like melding point between some of it. So I'm curious, yes. what your perspective on all of this, and who do you think is right in those three different perspectives? This is where I wanted to get to. We are finally at the place where I like finally can maybe challenge you a little.
Yeah. Yeah. I seem to be kind of casting myself in the sense of a tribunal apologist, so I'm going to stick with that for now.
Whatever you think. Yeah. You're just going to be judged for the rest of your lifetime on this response, so go ahead.
Oh, yeah, it's going on the internet, therefore forever. The perspective of the empire kind of muscling in on Morrowind, there's various texts that are there that say they just want the ebony, which is the wondrous metal that is probably Lorcan's blood, that they can then use to make all kinds of marvelous stuff, and so that's the root of the Imperials. Involvement there, the Cyrodiilic involvement. If you read certain texts, that's the whole reason why Tiber Septim put up with trying to invade them, because he knew it was going to be a hassle because they had living gods on their side. So there's that kind of naked commercial interest that's there in quite a few places, and I really like the layout of this kind of the southern areas of Morrowind, where you can kind of see both the Imperial stuff around the areas I'm thinking of are kind of Caldera, Pelgiad, those sorts of settlements, right. where you get this kind of frontier sense that these are people who are new and coming in and trying to make a home in this strange land, and that their architecture just doesn't fit at all.
Right, as opposed to the people that are living in Aztec buildings and structures, essentially.
Yes, because the rest of the buildings look like Aztec buildings and structures, it fits. Right. You've got that element of why the Empire is involved. The Imperial cult, which is the manifestation of the missionary arm of the religion of the Nine Divines, as it is then, that's purely a voluntary thing, as far as I can tell, because the treaty that got signed between Morrowind and the Empire at the end of Tiber's Wars, when Morrowind got incorporated into the Empire, it had certain guarantees about self-governance and maintenance of Dunmeri tradition, including slavery, by the way, that was still permitted, and whereas it's banned throughout the rest of the Empire. So the tradition, what was by then the traditional worship of the tribunal and religious affairs of the Dunmer, are purely an internal thing. So the imposition of the Imperial cult is just some well-meaning organizations within Cyrodiil have just said, we need to go and convert the heathens. It's nothing to do with Imperial policy, so to speak. In terms of making a nicer society, I'm not really sure, because the tribunal have tried to inculcate particular virtues into the Dunmer that should produce a reasonable society. I mean, you've got as part of the tribunal temple, you get taken through the pilgrimage of the seven graces, which I am just going to look up because I can't remember all of the seven graces, and they're lovely. that it's the seven graces of the Tribunal Faith are humility, daring, generosity, courtesy, justice, valor, and pride. I mean, apart from pride, I don't think there's anything you wouldn't really want there. So it's the Tribunal Temple are quite controlling as an organization, but as what they're trying to permeate Dunmer society with, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. The Tribunal Temple is all sorts of problematic because they suppress dissidents. They will take people away and murder them if they try and say that they're trying to overthrow them and so on. So there is a definite establishment of a state religion which is murderously supported in that sense. But as a faith itself, I don't necessarily have too much of a problem with it. Are the Tribunal gods as opposed to the Aedra? Gods. It's a loose term.
It seems more like an oligarchy than anything else. It seems more like that is their not necessarily seat of power because they have all of their political stuff behind them, but they are the deciding. Like when you run stuff up the Dark Elf ladder, they are at the very top.
Pretty much, yeah. Although there is Morrowind society is a little vague in that sense. I think you possibly get a bit of a skewed picture from the game because the Elder Scrolls III takes place on Vardenfell, which is which has been a temple preserve for years. It's been governed purely by the temple, with very very limited settlement allowed. At the time when you play the Elder Scrolls III. They're only fairly recently kind of opening it up to being an imperial provincial district, which is why you have those frontier towns. They've literally sprung up in the past few decades. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of the picture that you have of the landscape of the game. Morrowind as a whole province will have whole areas governed by the great houses, where the temple doesn't really have so much sway. In Vardenfell, the land is owned by the temple, and so the great houses had to lease it from them. In mainland Morrowind, I could be wrong here, but my impression is that the houses own the land, so I imagine the power dynamic would be a little different. Mm-hmm. And the houses basically function like semi-autonomous states. They have all their own. They have all their own guilds, their own traders, their own mages, and their own networks, everything else. I imagine kind of the politics like would be
a
bit
Game
different.
Of Thrones kind of situation with the kind of the different cities and
houses. Yeah, the different houses. Right. Yeah, absolutely. And so there's that difference to think through. I'm really hesitant to make any sort of call on right and wrong here, because
listen, I'm here for your hot take. Whatever your hot take is today, I mean that could change, but your hot take right now is what I'm searching for.
Okay, my hot take right now. Vivek is perfectly right because of Dune. This will take some unpacking here.
Okay.
How far through the Dune books have you read? Have you gone beyond the first novel?
I started Messiah, but I needed by the time I had gone into Messiah, I had decided that I probably needed to reread Dune. So it was like several years after Dune. So I'm familiar with the thought, and then there's essentially the main character of the series becomes all powerful. Kind of, you know, spoilers for Dune. Becomes all powerful, but that comes with certain consequences that change how I would guess the world of Dune, but really it's like the universe. Of Dune reacts. So
okay, in which case this is going a bit beyond what you've read so far, his son, Paul Atreides' son, Leto II. Mm-hmm. As he's called, at the end of the books Children of Dune, for which spoilers, I warn you, this next 5 minutes or so of talk at least is probably going to be spoilerific.
Dune, everyone excited.
Yeah,
he shut up. real disappointed.
Oh no, the story of the main novel is totally, and presumably the film is totally untouched. So, yes. but his son at the end of it basically becomes part sandworm, and in doing so ensures that he will live for thousands of years. And because he is the son of the emperor and the new emperor, he imposes a 1,000-year-long theocracy that then stagnates the Galactic Empire. He controls all of the flow of spice, so all space travel is kaput unless the emperor says so.
And as we all know, he who controls the spice controls the universe.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so he imposes this millennia-long theocracy in which culture stagnates and so on. But he also engineers the point where he dies. And as he dies, humanity gets scattered throughout the stars, and is more or less one of the other points about the whole series is how oppressive precognition and seeing the future is. So humanity kind of scatters among the stars and has ways of being immune to the effects of precognition. So they can do whatever they want. Translate that into Morrowind. The tribunal become gods. They became gods in the year 700 of the first era. Think back to what I said earlier. That's thousands of years of theocracy, which stagnates culture, which oppresses stuff, and then the tribunal are all destroyed by a means of their own choosing. As you said, that huge great rock hanging over Vivek City and so on, it's an enforced cataclysm on the Dunmer people after the tribunal will die, which will then scatter them to Tamriel. And don't know. There is a line in the book, in the 36 lessons, which I'm going to look up because I'm not going to mistranslate it. It begins something like, later, and by which I mean much later, my reign will be seen as an act of the highest love, which is a return from the astral destiny and the marriages between. That's basically Vivek saying, later on, my reign will be seen as something perfect, as something that was worthwhile, and what I did for my people. There's a line in God Emperor of Dune where you've basically got this guy's thought journals. You've got Leto II's thought journals saying that I will be the predator of humanity, but what I'm doing will be horribly misunderstood. I can't help but see parallels in how Vivek is written to that. And what Vivek did, or what Vivek did, what Leto did in the Dune books is to ensure the survival of humanity, to make sure that they are capable enough to survive whatever cataclysms get thrown at them after he's gone. So I because there are so many Dune parallels in Morrowind, I can't help but think of Vivek's intentions with the Red Year and everything else in the same light. So that's what I think. That's why I think that the tribunal is the way it was. It was intended to be oppressive, to foment rebellion, and to generate this feeling of discontent, which once the tribunal is gone, will explode out and create enough that the Dunmer people will survive.
I guess my follow up question to that is, and even separate from, I guess who is right in doing that? Do you think that creates the survival of the tribunal religion? Because it seems like there's a lot of parallels to not only Dune, but it may mean Dune parallels Lawrence of Arabia, parallels a lot of Islam, a lot of Christianity, and for the most part, it's after these like massive precognitive, I guess not necessarily, essentially deities or prophets die, then it becomes this widespread religion where it then leaves the motherland in which it was formed and kind of like spread across the earth. And so do you think from that perspective, do you think that the tribunal survive, or do you think that the Daedra, like, who do you think wins at the end of the day as far as the, you know, the battle of all these religions? Because it seems like that the whole that Azura wanted them dead, clearly. She didn't want them anymore. But did that really serve her purpose of making more followers for her in the long run? And I mean, this is kind of continuing past Skyrim, because we're dealing with we're literally dealing with Fallout, from the eruption of the volcano, from all of the different, you know, crazy, because then there's like this whole like racism thing of these people creating these communities in places that they haven't historically have been. So there's still a lot of fallout from that. But do you think that later on that will be the tribunal will still be a religion that's followed pretty heavily?
No, and we know this from the Elder Scrolls V. What happened was that there was a faction of priests within the Tribunal Temple that were challenging aspects of the Tribunal's faith and their divinity. And they basically, after the Lyrock hit Vivek City and destroyed it, they basically took over the temple hierarchy, because they were dispersed enough that they could. One of the things that Vivek says when you speak to him about what comes next, when his own once Daegothera is defeated, he'll say, "Oh, the tribunal will diminish. We will return to the worship of the Daedra," and so on. Which is pretty much what happened. The Dunmer go back to worshipping Azura, Mephala, and Boethia as the reclamations, and the tribunal assume a role as saints within the pantheon. So, do the tribunal survive? No, they don't. But there are elements of that survivability and what the tribunal taught the Dunmer, if they can be said to have taught them anything, that then survive in the ongoing Dunmer faith that returns to its roots as well.
Right. So in Skyrim, that's, from my understanding, that's the case. I'm curious about, because now they have this, like, they don't have a controlling, like, they have like government forces and mm-hmm. the ideology and tradition and history. But I'm curious if that's going to make a return. Like, if like the worship of the tribunal, even though they're dead, if that is going to be a prominent religion again, because like you've said, they're going to look back and see that, oh, the stuff that I'm doing is good. And so I'm curious if it's almost going to like do a turnaround. Like, if I'm talking about in like hundreds or I guess thousands of years in this case, like, is there going to be a turnaround where they're like, hey, you know what? Maybe we were right about that. And maybe that's a part of our, that's more a part of our history and our culture than the Daedra were in the first place.
Huh. Yeah, okay. I see. Yeah, the kind of, yeah, worship the tribunal, make Morrowind great again. Yeah. And
yeah, it's regressive, but I mean, that's how a lot of this stuff started, is, you know, like Christianity, absolutely. Was it after after Jesus had died in history, it wasn't a common religion by far. I mean, no. The Roman pantheon was still a thing, the Greek pantheon, you had the beginnings of Islam, you had a lot of pagan religions, you had a lot of stuff going on, and it really wasn't a thing until people were like, you know, maybe I can like make something out of this, and you know, I've learned these lessons of this thing, and like, how do I change that and make it more digestible for people across the way, even though these events have already happened and occurred, is I guess where I'm coming from with that.
Okay. Yeah. I think it's possible. You need some distance between the dissident priests and the temple hierarchy, as far as I'm concerned, because you need voices that would think, that are there to think, hey, actually the tribunal weren't that bad. And so long as you've got an ideology of the dissident priests, which cling to the idea of the Daedra as the right way to go, the Ashlanders were the guardians of truth all along, and that sort of thing, which is the prevailing opinion in the time of Skyrim. But once that's gone, then it's possible that sort of thing could happen. I mean, there's the seeds that of that sort of thing possibly happening, because House Indoril are no longer a thing after Red Year, particularly. They become pretty much the same thing as the Tribunal Temple. So if they want to create a political entity to do stuff with, then the remnants of House Indoril, I think, need to make it their own thing. And they can claim Almalexia as a descendant. She was of House Indoril, as was Nerevar. No, Sothisil definitely wasn't, and Vivek was probably a street urchin.
I'm thinking just more in like in terms of like rose tinted glasses. Like I would assume that the Dark Elves would still suffer from that, and then in several hundred years look back and go, you know what? Maybe that was pretty good. Maybe all that was pretty good. Why don't we rally behind that rather than some other thing? Because that's more Dark Elf than it is anything else. And they're very, very concerned with tradition and
I could see that happening as the remnants of House Indoril making a power play with the temple, and trying to reassert their own influence and using the tribunal as a guise for that. But I'm not sure I could see that necessarily for the rest of the Dunmer, because the tribunal's whole shtick is that they're living gods, that they're gods you can go and have a conversation with, and they will go actually physically go up and move that mountain if you really want them to, and they think it's the right thing to do. Whereas they're not really around to do that anymore. So you'd need a different way of presenting the tribunal than what they historically were, if you were going to come up with that. So I think it's unlikely, but it would certainly be an interesting mix.
I'm going to pull you to this. Let me tell you something. By the time Six comes out and there's like a town crier holding up a poster of Vivek that's like, "Remember our one true God," you're gonna come crying to me and you're gonna be like, "All right, man, listen, you got this right from the get go."
Quite possibly. Yeah. Although I am going to say that's more likely to be Almalexia than Vivek, because she does have the line of bow down before your one true God before she tries to kill you.
Right. Of course. Yes.
so yeah.
See, you came into this thinking that you were playing with the dunce, but look at me now. We're like, you know.
No, not at all.
Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show and doing a deep dive just on all things Morrowind and how it relates to space, from environment to political to religion. Yep. There's so many different inspirations in this game. It's a wonderful game. You should go and check out. I just realized today that you could actually get a mod and play it on an Android phone at like 60 FPS, which is absolutely insane that you can just go and do that in modern times, make it open source and all the stuff. There's a bunch of mods. You can go and tailor it to however you want, because it's a wonderful, delightful Bethesda game. And you have this other podcast called Written in Uncertainty. Why don't you give me a little pitch on that? Tell me what you're up to.
Written in Uncertainty is basically, as I kind of said at the start, it's a podcast that I began because I wanted to say, well, people are hearing about all these esoteric ideas and not knowing where they come from. So it's a podcast that explains where all these ideas like Dragon Breaks and Chim and Where the Dwarves Went is the first episode. How the Amaranth works, some more of my thoughts on Vivek. There's a whole episode on each of the members of the tribunal, and I also unpack various other things, like questions to do with the races. Like I'm currently wending my way through some notes on the Dareni. The most recent completed episode is on the origins and nature of the Bretons. So it's a grab bag of where all these ideas come from, and it's kind of just going a bit more than just, this is what stuff is. This is where stuff came from. This is what stuff means. And in the context of the Elder Scrolls lore, I bring in real world religion, real world philosophy, and basically a grab bag of stuff, whatever I can use to explain the Elder Scrolls lore. And I also am a member of the Selectives Lorecast, which is a round table of Elder Scrolls nerds, of which I am the least, we get together every 2 weeks to discuss some topic or other. At the moment, we are were on a series going through the Daedric Princes. I don't know exactly when this is going to air, so I can't say what the next episode is going to be. It's basically us going for about an hour and a half and seeing what we can dig out of all the various concepts to do with just a particular topic with the Elder Scrolls. That's pretty much all my stuff.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for coming to the show, Remarathius.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you ever so much for having me.
Thanks again to Aramithius for coming on the show. It's exciting to have somebody that's so passionate about the Elder Scrolls lore and to be able to talk back and forth and dissect these interesting examples in the game and see kind of how they relate to real life. I want to make an announcement in that the episodes, essentially, I was planning on doing them 1 week at a time, a week for one, a week for the next, but those often became what I consider too short, and then when I went to go write a long one, it became too much to do within a week. So I'll make a deal with you. We're going to do a new episode every 2 weeks. It's going to be a long-form episode where I most likely sit down with somebody and have a conversation with them or multiple people about a particular video game and the subjects. I will enjoy that a lot more, and I think that you will too. As far as short-term content, I'm actually going to start doing reviews. So expect to see some reviews come out in October. They're probably going to be short, 5 to 7 minutes reviews of games that are coming out. It's going to be from a different perspective, though. It's not going to be from a gameplay or what you would consider a traditional review. It's going to be from a geographic point of view, how well they adapt a world, how great the mapping or pathing is within a game. I'm putting together a rubric. I'd kind of planned on doing this from the get-go and was curious of how to work it in, but I think these smaller, I guess I would call them mini-sodes. It's fun to do a little mini-sode, but it's also going to be a review, and it'll be in the podcast platform as well. As always, you can follow the show at Geography Arcade. Make sure to send your emails in if you want to contact the show at thegeographyarcade@gmail.com. Links for all of this are in the show notes. I include a big link tree of the sponsors, of the ads, of all of this stuff. It's all in the show notes, and it's pretty easy to get to. We have a Discord server. You can join that. You can join the Robots Radio Discord server, and I have another podcast I call The Fallout Hub that I do with my friends Ken and Tom that runs every Monday where we talk Fallout information. I hope that you all have a great week. Come there, come and look upon the heart. Upon the heart. Bull, lay down your weapon. It is not too late for my mercy. Bull, come and look upon the heart.
Hey friends, this is Robots, the creator of the Robots Radio Podcast Network and host of the two original shows on the network, the Fallout Lorecast and the Elder Scrolls Lorecast. These two shows have rocketed up the iTunes charts. They both together have over 150 five-star reviews in only a couple of months, with bite-sized episodes that take you step-by-step through the background of the games and the game worlds. They're thought-provoking, well-produced, and a lot of fun. I recommend you go check them out at robotsradio.net or on any podcast reader, podcatcher, whatever you use, iTunes, Spotify. Again, that's the Fallout Lorecast and the Elder Scrolls Lorecast, available everywhere.